WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and every day more than 130 people in the United States die after overdosing on opioids, according to the latest statistics from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. As you probably know, the crisis has been evolving for the past three decades, but more people are also taking on Big Pharma to help change bad practices and hold them accountable. Journalist Beth Macy has been covering the opioid epidemic since it began, spending time with addicts and their loved ones, doctors, pharmaceutical sales reps, police officers, and really the whole cast of characters affected by the spread of opioids to find out how this happened and why it is so hard to stop, but how we can try. And she joins me now to talk about her book, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America, which is now out in paperback. Beth, thanks so much for coming on today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
People may have seen your recent New York Times op-ed, the one called The Four Ordinary People Who Took On Big Pharma, in which you write about a group called RAP, or Relatives Against Purdue Pharma, trying to hold the Purdue company accountable for the sale of OxyContin. Can you explain what it is that these four ordinary people are doing?
Yeah, so in the early days when people first started really realizing that this drug, in fact, was addictive, unlike everything the company was saying about it, they thought they were all alone. And there was this IT guy from Philly who had lost his son, Eddie, at age of 18. And the first time he heard the word OxyContin, his son was dead from it. And he, in his grief, he had early computer skills, and he started message boards. I don't know if y'all remember those, but this was before the internet was widespread. And suddenly, parents from all over the nation kind of joined his efforts, and he started a message board called OxyKills.com. And they started just realizing they weren't alone, and then they started protesting at physician meetings where Purdue would hire folks to come be paid speakers for the company and things of that nature. And then eventually they started feeding information to a nascent federal investigation that culminated in what was still the largest settlement against Purdue for criminally misbranding the drug.
Criminally misbranding the drug. And I think that's an important takeaway here, because people might think, well, these were prescription painkillers and that was considered a good thing. It was, you know, even a movement in the medical field in the 1990s to help alleviate the pain more that people were having. I'm sure you remember this. Tell me if this is in the book, that, you know, the movement was people being left in pain too much after surgery or whatever, and they don't have to be because there are drugs that can treat that. But at the same time, they were covering up how addictive they were.
Exactly. So it was called, and Purdue and other pharma companies helped fund this idea that pain was now the fifth vital sign. We have a great epidemic of untreated pain. But what the company did more than anything was they made it so that they flipped the narrative from 100 years following the Civil War. We had a huge morphine epidemic, and we knew for most of the 1900s that opioids should only be used in severe pain, end of life, cancer, to now these drugs, because OxyContin is so, quote, safe, it can be used for moderate pain, arthritis, TMJ, jaw pain, all manner of kind of moderate issues. And that helped these pills just, you know, 76 billion pills get shipped to these tiny communities between 2006 and 2012, more pills than people in many of these towns. And what, you know, the headlines you're seeing now about pills especially going to these distressed communities, which were like the first communities where we really knew that this was going to be a problem because the jobs were going away and it just decimated some of these rural communities.
So let's roll back the clock to 1998, and here's a clip from an ad from Purdue Pharma in that year, 21 years ago, called I Got My Life Back, where Dr. Alan Spanos promotes the benefits of OxyContin.
There's no question that our best, strongest pain medicines are the opioids, but these are the same drugs that have a reputation for causing addiction and other terrible things. Now, in fact, the rate of addiction amongst pain patients who are treated by doctors is much less than 1%. They don't wear out, they go on working, they do not have serious medical side effects, and so these drugs, which I repeat, are our best, strongest pain medications, should be used much more than they are for patients in pain.
So that sounds like a soundbite of somebody. It doesn't sound like a commercial. What's the context for that?
So, yeah, Purdue hired people who were really important in the field, people like Dr. Spanos, people like Dr. Portnoy, big pain doctors who were advocates, and they pushed this notion that pain was being undertreated. And then they hired an army of sales reps, and the reps would go to doctors, particularly doctors in distressed communities where they were already prescribing competing opioids, and then would say, hey, we've got this new opioid. It's safer than the immediate-release opioids presently on the market, like Lortab, Vicodin, Percocet, and you should use our drug. And what it was just like the nuclear bomb of opioids. It had way more drug. And users very quickly figured out an end run around the time-release mechanism that was supposed to make it safer.
Listeners, who has a story or a question for journalist Beth Macy, author of the book Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America, now out in paperback, 212-433-WNYC. If you or a loved one has experienced opioid addiction, what was your path? Were you prescribed OxyContin or some other opioid for an injury or other medical reason? Did you ever feel you were unnecessarily prescribed? And I'd be curious, too, though we only have a few minutes, if there are any doctors or medical professionals of other kinds out there, have you ever felt pressure doctors to prescribe opioids, or maybe you felt you had the wool pulled over your eyes as to how much harm these drugs could actually do? Doctors, what was your learning curve? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Has your increased awareness of overdose deaths changed the way you prescribe pain management drugs now? Beth, I think a particularly vivid image from your book is when you describe how you could start to tell people were abusing OxyContin. People were figuring out how to get the medication into their bloodstream faster than it was intended, for example, by letting the coating dissolve in their mouths, wiping the pills on their sleeves, and crushing them for an instant high. And you said you saw these telling stains on people's clothing, stains in the late 1990s, but Purdue said they didn't know people were abusing the drug until after that. So what was going on?
Yeah, so the first cop that really saw OxyContin being diverted, and this is in rural Southwest Virginia, he said you could see people with orange and green stains, and that was the 40 and the 80 milligram of the pill. And some early people started calling them and saying, please take this off the market until it can be reformulated to be abuse resistant. And one of the doctors I write about, Dr. Art Van Zee, he writes them a letter in 2000 saying, my fear is that these distressed communities are the sentinel areas, just like New York and San Francisco were in the early years of HIV. And of course, he was so prescient. But he and other early kind of whistleblower types were just blown off. They were described as kooks. And even some of the early whistleblowers from the company that tried to take them on were you know, with their one lawyer in a courtroom facing a phalanx of lawyers that Purdue had hired, they were just outgunned at every turn.
Let's take a phone call from a doctor. This is Dr. Roy, who says he is an addiction specialist. Doctor, thank you for calling in.
Hi there, Brian. Good afternoon. And hi, Beth. I had the pleasure of meeting Beth and reading her book, Dope Sick. So I'm an internal medicine and addiction medicine doctor here in New York. And I really reiterate a lot of the stories that Beth has painstakingly shared in her book. As somebody who takes care of men and women who struggle with all types of drug addiction, alcohol, opioids, benzos, you name it. Addiction is a chronic medical disease of the brain. It is not a sign of moral weakness or failure. Unfortunately, stigma remains a major barrier to people getting the care that they need and deserve. And Beth is absolutely right about the major role that Purdue Pharma played. Doctors like me also played a role, but we were told that these drugs, like OxyContin, they're not addictive, line number one. And line number two, they said that opioids were evidence-based for treating chronic pain long-term. Absolutely false. And doctors like me, we just don't get the training in addiction and less so in pain management. And that needs to change. And slowly, I think that's actually changing.
Thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it. Can I go to Alice? Here we are. Alice in Tenafly, a hospice nurse. Alice, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I do treat people at end of life, and I treat people also on home care. And I do believe that pain is the fifth vital sign. There may be abuse out there. People are going to abuse anything. They abuse Sudafed and made it very difficult for me to get Sudafed medication, which is probably the only thing that works for me when I have a cold. But the oxycodones, the morphine, I do believe that people coming out of acute situations and surgery are under-medicated. And people are so fearful of getting addicted that they don't take enough medication for their pain in the beginning. They are supposed to be used short-term, unless, of course, it's end-of-life care, when they're going to use it until they die. So I do believe that people are under-medicating. They're not using the medications appropriately, and I think because of all of these new regulations that the doctors are fearful for their license, and they are under-medicating their patients many times.
Beth Macy, talk to Alice. How do we not fall off one side or the other of this equation?
Right. Well, we don't do anything with nuance very well in this country, unfortunately. And absolutely, somebody at end of life or somebody with cancer or post-surgery should absolutely be able to get these drugs. But what happened is they were prescribed for every little kind of hangnail. And now the genie's out of the bottle. We have 2.6 million Americans addicted. And the pendulum has swung the other way. And studies are coming out showing that people who are on stable doses of painkillers and have not been abusing them are being suddenly cut off. And that's not good either. What we need to be talking about is how to get the 2.6 million Americans addicted help, how to get them into medication-assisted treatment programs like Dr. Roy does in the prisons in New York and in the jails, and how to get them help.
Alice, thank you very much for an important contribution. You also write in the book about a sales rep strategy that some of the pharmaceutical companies used called Dine and Dash. A lot of our listeners, some of our listeners may have heard of, you know, Dine and Dash as leaving a restaurant without paying for your meal. But what does it mean in the pharma industry context?
Oh, we're going to rent out a really nice room in a nice restaurant, and we're going to invite you to come have a juicy steak and in exchange for a quick pitch about our drug. And it happened with all drugs, not just Purdue. There was one doctor who put up a sign-up sheet for her kid's birthday party. A rep could come and sponsor to take her kid to Carowinds Amusement Park. And one rep, not a Purdue rep, did that. And that was kind of the Wild West of pharma rep days. And thank goodness, isn't happening anymore.
Why Dope Sick? Why is that the title? Did you coin that word?
I didn't coin it. I heard it from every single addicted person that I interviewed. It's what they call withdrawal. And so it's crushing. They say, I'm dope sick. I can't get my drug. Anxiety, depression, diarrhea, vomiting, nausea, restless leg. And as one person early in the book says, at the end of your journey, you're not going after heroin to get high. You're just doing it so as not to be dope sick. And that's why it's so important to get people on these life-saving medications, which protect them and prevent cravings and allow them to get their lives back on track and recover.
Marie in Seaford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest a question if it was in her book. One thing that disturbs me in this whole story is that the same big pharma companies that have created this addiction are the same ones profiting off of Narcan. And it's extremely expensive for communities to use it to save lives. So I find there's a huge conflict of interest there, and that they are double profiting off of this situation. I didn't know if you covered that or have thought that in your reporting.
Beth, the anti-overdose drug being made by the same companies that make the drugs people are overdosing on?
Well, we know that we have to provide these Narcan to reverse overdoses, because you can't get better if you're dead. And we're seeing in some New England states that are starting to have gradual reductions in their overdose deaths. They're making Narcan widely available. They're making buprenorphine in the jails widely available. We know what works. We're just not doing it yet to the scale that matches the epidemic.
Do any 2020 candidates have a plan for really fighting opioid addiction? Everybody talks about it. I don't know that there's a plan. We have 20 seconds.
Yeah, there's a lot of sound bites, but Elizabeth Warren has a really terrific plan. It calls for $100 billion to go into making an addiction treatment system that is woven into the fabric of our healthcare system. It's she's really the only one out there talking about it on a daily basis. And, you know, President Trump says he's fixed the opioid crisis. We had a slight reduction in overdose deaths, but still the second highest. Those are preliminary figures. The second highest in record.
We'll do a separate segment on this in the context of the presidential race. For now, we thank Beth Macy, author of Dope Sick. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.